Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. As we approach Indigenous Resistance Days on October 12th, we'll spend the last part of our show with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, longtime activist in the American Indian Movement and author of several books, including Indians of the Americas, Human Rights and Self-Determination, and Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, 1680-1980. Welcome, Roxanne, to the show. Good to have you on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on your show.
Well, you know, I've been reading over the couple of weeks some of your pieces, and I'm always going back to them, and they're very helpful for me, especially the ones you've been writing for the Monthly Review. I most recently read the one that came out in the July and August edition of this year about the piece about Indigenous people and the left in Latin America. And I wanted to spend some time with you to exchange some of these thoughts and notes about some of your writings. But first, you know, the reason why I particularly wanted to have you on is, you know, October 12th is coming soon. And for me, you know, 15 years ago in 1992, when at the 500-year sort of like cusp of the coming of Columbus to this continent, it was a very transformative moment for me in my political development, because the Indigenous movement was, you know, able to really articulate a politic of resistance that was very helpful for me to understand racism and white supremacy. You write often a lot about white supremacy and imperialism, but how do you reflect on this date of October 12th of 1492?
Well, you know, I always feel in the Indigenous communities, whether it's urban here in San Francisco or in Indian country or even in other countries other than the U.S., there's a sort of dread in the air that, oh, no, we have to, it's kind of a stealing of your body and mind, that you have to prepare for this onslaught of celebrating genocide, celebrating colonialism. And it feels like a setback every year, but since 1992, when, I mean, Indigenous people have been fighting back for 500 years, and very powerfully, and especially in the 1970s, this, you know, comeback was a huge movement going the international stage. But 1992, like you say, was really a turning point. It was sort of a drawing the line in the sand that this has got to stop. And even though it hasn't stopped, there is a popular acceptance that this is not appropriate, that it is and should be an international day of mourning for the Indigenous people of the Americas, and that is spreading. You know, so even though the official holiday is still there, it's like many things in this society, is seen as rather inappropriate. To most people, or if you explain it like I do to my students, if they haven't gotten it yet, it takes them about 5 minutes to understand and say, yeah, that shouldn't be. But this year, I think, is a particularly triumphant moment of because of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples just passed in the General Assembly of the United Nations after 30 years of very hard work by Indigenous representatives in difficult circumstances, lobbying the United Nations, lobbying hundreds of countries in the world. A seemingly impossible task if you really laid it out that, say, in 1970, that, okay, this is what Indigenous people are going to do, and by 2007, there will be international law for the protection of Indigenous peoples, and a declaration for acknowledging their rights to self-determination. Mm. I think anyone would have said at that time, this is ridiculous, you know, that can't happen. And mm-hmm. It has. And so I think this is a particularly triumphant feeling this year. I myself have brought out one of the books you referred to, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, which is kind of my case study of in some detail of colonialism in one place. and it has come out in a new edition this month, and I'll be going down to New Mexico to spend the time before, at, and after. A bunch of us are going to do a kind of onslaught for Indigenous peoples' time instead of Columbus. But it really feels like a triumph rather than what it usually feels like, a kind of defensive, you know, and disgruntled.
Well, why don't you, like I said, earlier I had read this piece about Indigenous people on the left and the Monthly Review, and another aspect of, I guess, I don't know, triumph for sure, you know, the rise of the strength of the Indigenous movements in places like Ecuador and in Bolivia in particular. And obviously, it can't be said enough that obviously Evo Morales is the president, has been elected as president of that country. In your view, you know, I was reading the piece, and I thought in some ways it was very important to where you're articulating the need particularly for the left to understand the national question, and in some ways, while the national question has always been described, particularly here in the United States, around the issue of black people in this country, in some ways in Latin America, the issue of Indigenous people has been completely not described well or unscientifically talked about in their sort of social and economic understanding of these folks.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that left parties in all of the Americas have had a really, I think in Latin America, first of all, like I said in that article, you have to see they're looking at from the birth of their nations as independent nations, they're looking at the United States as a predator. So nationalism became the core of whatever ideology they picked up, and in 20th century Marxism, so they transformed Marxism, as a lot of the decolonization movement did, into rather than a goal of socialism per se, I mean that was one goal, or anti-capitalism, into anti-imperialism and nationalism. And that's completely understandable, and it's gone a long ways, you know, in mobilizing populations, but it also, and you know, just really critically so in those nations in Latin America that have majority indigenous populations, it has simply subsumed them under the rubric of campesino, you know, or peasants, and in some cases as workers in Mexico. So that, like Mariátegui perceived, and as did the Soviets, you know, in the 1930s, in scolding the Latin American communist parties that class is 90% of the national question, but that other 10% is key. Without it, you know, you cannot mobilize the masses without also addressing their self-determination issues. And I think that's something that's been really, really difficult for Marxist parties all over the world. Because you look at India, it's also been difficult. Also, I think they've moved along very quickly in the last 20 years or so in changing. It's been definitely a kind of Achilles heel in Latin America. In the United States, I think what it does, since the populations are, the indigenous populations are so small due to genocide, that the leftist parties or organizations or movements can't get the history straight. You know, when they ignore the native population, or simply feel guilty or play a little lip service, oh yes, of course we support, and they support Leonard Peltier, they support certain figures, and it's a kind of, or they put an indigenous person at the front of the parade with a drum, but they they don't really then say, well, what does this mean? They're calling for self-determination. What does that mean in terms of the whole United States? and its history, and they don't change that. They too are nationalists. You know, they don't think of themselves as nationalists, but I don't know how many of these books, you know, I've been reading about the Iraq War that by liberals and some people I'd have to call leftists who simply talk about getting back to the roots of our, you know, of our democracy and values without really understanding that the United States, from its inception, was an imperialist power with a colonizing mission. And because they don't take up the Indian question, they don't take up the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that has just made, in many ways, leftist parties and movements crash in the United States because they don't know who the enemy is. They don't know who they're struggling against. They don't know this is an oligarchy. They don't understand capitalism. And, you know, they might have the rhetoric, but they don't really understand that it's tied up with the land and the taking of the land. So I think and the other thing is the moral values. I loved, you probably saw Evo Morales on Democracy Now! Last mm-hmm. week. And this one sentence of his, "I'm convinced that indigenous peoples are the moral reserve of humanity." I think that is, you know, that is so clear, and he's so absolutely right that it's why I feel hopeful all the time, whereas most of my left friends feel, because they're not in touch with this, you know, what's going on sort of under the radar, they feel depressed and hopeless, because it's, but it has to, I mean, it has to have mass support, because these are small numbers in many countries, and it wouldn't be the first time if there's a coup in Bolivia of putting the indigenous people down and slaughtering them, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. You know, I wanted to go back to what you had said. I think, you know, I think that is the big divide among the left here in the United States. You know, in an earlier piece you had written back in 2003, I remember, can't remember the full title, but I know it's about cowboys and Indians. You really did sort of go back, not only to 1492, you went back to, you know, the origins of Protestants and Calvinists and the reconquest of the white Iberians against the Moors as sort of the sort of root of imperialism inside white supremacy and how that ideology was cemented during that time period. And I think in many ways, people in the United States do not see the do not sort of come to the conclusion that the United States is a white settler nation, and that from the very big, from the very, you know, sort of origins, then unfortunately that no longer is there a sort of classic class divide between the rich and the poor, but more importantly, who is the oppressed and who are the slaves.
Right. Yeah, the putting the
Roxanne, you're on?
Rather than an exceptional case, you know, that United States exceptionalism has always been the rule of how it's approached, even by other people, although outside observers often have some insights, but from Alex de Tocqueville to Humboldt and others who traveled around the United States, they also saw the United States as unique because they weren't seeing the indigenous people. And there was this hope, you know, that there could be a worthy European civilization, I think, and that the United States was that beacon. And it's really such a false idea and so harmful that, and also I think for young people who generation after generation grow up in this country, can't help but at least subconsciously know that it's a lie because it doesn't match up with what they observe. And I think it really messes people's minds up, you know, a lot. And that the truth would actually be very liberating, even though it's not very pleasant. It's not pleasant for me to think that my father's family were those Scots-Irish frontiersmen, Indian fighters, you know, killing Indians and taking their land. And even though they ended up dirt poor themselves, they still have this mentality, you know, of superiority. It's not pleasant to deal with those things, but it doesn't, and in doing so, it doesn't do any good to feel guilty about it either, guilt, because I'm not responsible for what my Scots-Irish forebear did on the frontier in the 17th century, but I am responsible for what happens now, you know, and to understand that history. And I have that little reminder, you know, my mother being half Indian, that I guess I had a certain insight that I could have, although it wasn't automatic. And had the movement not come along in the 1960s, I don't know that I would have understood so well. So I don't think it's very easy. You know, it's hard to condemn people because it's one of the closest kept secrets in every generation. It's just not there for people to pick up. It's not on the internet. It's not anywhere. It doesn't come automatically. It's almost accidental if someone runs into this, you know, this phenomena. Oh, you know, this is Indians aren't just tragic figures or poor, pitiful, or extinct, or, you know, all of these different things. But actually, the only people that really know the history of the United States. And so I think we have a real responsibility to spread that. And I've been working at it. Every time I write an article or a book, whatever the subject is, I try to ground it in that history to make it understood. But it really isn't very prevalent. We have a really good development. There are so many wonderful young indigenous historians, a whole crop of them in the 1990s, and still, you know, getting out of graduate schools, and they have are coming out with some books. Jennifer Denatali, a Navajo historian at University of New Mexico, has just published an amazing history of the colonization of the Navajo Nation, and so this is going to make a big difference, as these, you know, that there's something to give people so they can read it and understand it, because there really hasn't been that much. But for your listeners, I would say one of the best sources to go to that seems counterintuitive, but is the UN.org, the United Nations website, and go to the High Commissioner for Human Rights issues and find Indigenous people, and you will find an absolute archive of 30 years of Indigenous research, of papers, not at all in, you know, UN language, all the compilation of everything that's taken place. And I think people would really find it interesting to explore this phenomena of the international Indigenous movement.
Well, thank you, Roxanne Dunbar-Tease. Again, Roxanne has been very long time activist and author of several books, and I really encourage folks to go look for it. One of the latest things here is this monthly review that came out in July of August 2007. You can catch a piece of her. So thank you for being on the show. That ends today's show of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Manuel Criollo. We'd like to thank our guests, Monica Cordova, Bran Fenner, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Today we heard music from Tower Power, Pharoah Sanders, Eulalie, and Los Warawaos. You can listen to previous shows at www.thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Christine Blasdo and Alan Minsky, our production assistant, Lisa Aller and Dehan Sung, our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.